The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This spring, across New Hampshire, students are supposed to take a new standardized test called the Smarter Balanced Assessment, tied to the Common Core. Some districts have already moved ahead on this, while in others, a backlash has developed, and the familiar arguments are being heard about all the ways standardized tests are, according to opponents anyway, ruining public education. This hour in The Exchange, we dive into some of those arguments at the national level as we talk with NPR education blogger Anya Kamenetz. Her new book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Let's hear from you. What's your take on standardized tests? Do they have a role to play in tracking how our schools and our kids are doing? Or should we get rid of them or just not have so many? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Anya joins us from New York City. Anya, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's been a lot of pushback on standardized tests lately, not just in New Hampshire, but as you write, around the country. What's this all about, Anya?
Well, since No Child Left Behind became federal law in 2002, our students have been taking an unprecedented number of tests. The law mandated that each child be tested every year in math and reading in grades 3 through 8, plus once in high school. And those tests would be attached to stakes. So there's accountability measures that schools, that districts, that states, that individual students, and finally that teachers are feeling as a result of these tests. So more tests and higher stakes tests adds up to the situation we're in right now.
And let's talk about the stakes, if we could. Because you use that term a lot and others do too, high-stakes testing. When No Child Left Behind first came out, it was presented as the stakes were that the district would be judged, that the school would be judged, but that the individual teacher and the individual student would not be judged.
Right. And the fact is that, you know, different tests are given different stakes for different reasons. And some states started to use these tests for grade promotion, which was, in fact, high stakes for individual students, as well as to make decisions about placement, about, you know, diagnostically. And then since Race to the Top in 2009, more and more states began to include some form of test scores in teacher evaluations. And that has proved very controversial as well.
Teachers don't want their whole evaluation tied to, you know, what happened to a particular grade in a particular year. There might have been, half the kids might have had some severe learning difficulties, and then they get graded on that.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which these models tying test scores to teacher performance have holes in them because, you know, the tests are only in math and reading, and yet teachers teach all kinds of subjects. What about team teachers? What about, you know, students that join the class mid-year? So there's just all kinds of ways in which it's very complicated to get that right.
So are any tests among this panoply of standardized tests, not just the national ones, but state ones, some states even have district ones, are there any low stakes tests? And should tests be low stakes? Because it seems like kids could blow them off if they knew it was low stakes.
Well, you know, I mean, assessments are part of good teaching practice. Every teacher needs to create assessments and give feedback to students. And the wide range of tests that students are taking today include diagnostic tests that, you know, again, help place them into the correct level, benchmark tests that kind of see how a student's doing and give intermediate information. And so, you know, I think it's important to separate the difference between a test that's high stakes is one that's being used to make decisions that have consequences. And when you really just want information, you know, there's a lot of indications that you can get much more accurate information if you, in fact, don't attach stakes to a test, because it's human nature. Once there's consequences attached, people are going to try to start gaming the system.
Yeah. Well, I remember the kneecaps here in New England, the New England Common Assessment Program. These have been pushed out recently, but our kids and their friends, you know, the buzz was the kneecaps don't count. It's just to assess the school. It doesn't count for my grade. So, you know, kids just kind of blow it off.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there's an argument to be made around that. You know, the question is then what is the purpose of a test like that?
Right.
How many tests do we need? Yeah.
Right.
How many tests do we need to be giving students? Although I would say that, you know, for example, the NAEP, the Nation's Report Card, that's a no stakes test that's given diagnostically. And it's done in a sampling on a sampling basis across the country and has been for decades. And people seem to feel that it's pretty reliable despite the factor that you're talking about, sort of the blow off factor.
So is it, Anya, that the tests inherently themselves are bad, or is it just the way that we use them?
Well, I think, you know, you can look at a test as a tool, and it's a tool in the education toolbox, a standardized test that's normed on a bell curve. And it has strengths and weaknesses, but when we pile all of these consequences on top of it, we're really overloading these tests. We're making them do more work than they were ever designed to do. And the people who create and market these tests are the first ones to tell you, you know, they don't have the magical knowledge of what it means for a student to be proficient. And they certainly don't have the ability to produce all the information we need about how a student got that way and what they need to do next. So we shouldn't be, you know, the argument being made by opponents is that we shouldn't be piling so many consequences onto what in the end is a pretty limited measurement of certain kinds of knowledge. And you know, we're not even trying to test subjects beyond basic math and reading skills.
So don't make it the end all be all. Use it as one tool in a very fat toolbox.
Yeah, I mean, a full palette of assessments, multiple measures, these are the kinds of terms that that test reformers are using.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look closer at the issue of standardized testing, how these tests are used, whether we have too many these days. Anya Kamenetz is with us. She's lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her newest book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, but you don't have to be. We'd love to hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You know, you talk a lot in the book, Anya, about No Child Left Behind in the early 2000s. As you said, it really seemed to get a lot of people focused on this issue. But the goal of NCLB was that every child be followed, be assessed. Supporters said, hey, this is a good thing. Districts need to be accountable for the progress of every kid, no matter what issues he or she may bring to the table. Just step back, if you could, Anya, please. What do you think about the big goals of NCLB?
Well, I did a story about this recently and talked about, you know, No Child Left Behind was really unassailable on a rhetorical level. And, you know, it's still supported by civil rights groups today, because the key provision of the law, as you mentioned, is that schools be required to report out the performance of low-income minority groups, people who are English language learners, and those with learning disabilities, and that we can no longer hide the performance of those students below the average or practice what George W. Bush called the soft bigotry of low expectations. And, you know, I think that remains a very, very important goal today. What critics are asking is whether equity and what's called the achievement gap is really being served by sort of a test and punish system. Because what we've seen over the last decade or so is, you know, many, many high poverty schools being closed, being reorganized, a lot of dislocation in urban school districts. But the achievement gap has remained pretty stubborn.
So the goal was good, but it turns out that this high stakes testing regime isn't the way to do it?
Well, I guess, you know, the idea is that that you can measure a gap, but measuring the gap is not going to make you to close the gap. You know, like measuring the corn in your cornfield doesn't make it grow faster. You have to be applying other kinds of reforms as well.
Well, and you write about that, you know, the accountability movement that we've seen with tests as the main tool. But in the book, you call for something, Anya, and I wonder if this is what you're talking about now, resource accountability. What is that?
Right. So this is an idea that goes back to the early 90s and was kind of in play, during the Clinton administration, which is called the broader, bolder approach to education. And resource accountability is the idea that we should not just hold our schools accountable, but we should hold our districts and our states accountable for the resources that are given to schools. Right now, only 14 states in the union actually make any attempt to level the playing field in terms of giving more funding to poorer districts, which obviously need greater resources for all kinds of reasons. And most states are content to have either flat funding or actually allow rich districts to get more resources. And so, despite attempts on the federal level to try to, allocate more resources to poor schools, there's still a whole lot of work to be done in terms of just providing these schools the resources that they need and the students the resources that they need to be set up for success.
So has any district really done this, saying, hey, before I hold you accountable, school or district, accountable for high scores on that standardized test, I will be accountable to you to give you the tools you need. Has anybody really done that?
Well, there's been a lot of attempts. New Jersey is a state that's well known for its legal battles over the allocation of funding. And California is trying something called the local control funding formula. And the idea there is to have districts involved in the budget process to allow them to say, this district is really needing extra resources around English language learners, and this district really needs credit recovery for high school students. So, there are attempts across the country to look at this, but of course, the trick with education reform is that the whole standards rigor and accountability movement they've separated out the conversation and said, well, it's not really about funding. It's not about giving resources. It's just if we use the money differently, we'd be able to get results.
Interesting. So some people are talking about it in different places, but not really. We're more focused on these tests and what the scores
are.
Well,
for now, we're focused on the tests. I mean, the idea here is education has always been seen as the magic formula to get people out of poverty and increase opportunity. And it's easier in some ways to talk about the importance of education than it is to talk about what about the minimum wage? What about, healthcare programs? What else could we do to deal with poverty head on?
All right. And again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. After a short break, we'll go to you. We'd love your questions and comments about standardized tests. Do they have a role in our public education system in terms of telling us how our kids, how our schools are doing? Should we get rid of standardized tests? Should we just not have as many as we seem to have these days? We'd love to hear from you after a break. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And coming up, more conversation with Anya Kamenetz on her book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Anya Kamenetz. She's lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her newest book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Anya, I have a lot more questions for you, but let's go to our listeners. And Timothy's in Sugar Hill. Hi, Timothy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning, Timothy. Go ahead.
I've been in education for about 30 years now, and one of the things that I'd like to point out is that the testing program is driven largely by large corporations that are making tremendous profits on these tests, and that they spend a great deal of money lobbying at the state and at the national level. And I think that needs to be recognized, that this is not a grassroots operation.
Well, and Timothy, I definitely want to talk about that because Anya writes about, follow the money. But as a longtime educator, Timothy, what do you think? Should we have no standardized tests? Should we have a few? What are your thoughts?
My best teaching experiences have been where there were no or little or no tests at all. And that to me, the real measure of student performance is what they do with the knowledge afterwards. And it's always wonderful to see what happens to a student who really can apply their knowledge and grow with it.
Okay. Well, Timothy, thank you for calling in. What do you think? Follow the money, Anya.
Sure. I mean, it definitely stands to be mentioned that most high-stakes standardized tests are created by a very small and concentrated industry that does, in fact, get involved in the political process. It's interesting to note because the tests like the Smarter Balance that you're taking in New Hampshire were actually created by nonprofit consortia that were funded by the federal government. So it's a little bit of a different way of organizing the interests involved. But, it's still very important to look at the role, for example, of technology companies. Like now these new Common Core aligned tests are being given on computers, and there's a lot of money coming towards schools in the form of wireless connections and computers, devices, as well as the tests themselves.
Yeah, so that's the concern that we're hearing in New Hampshire, not just about the usual arguments that we hear about standardized tests and concerns around those, but that some districts are quite rural and don't have the capacity to administer these on the computer. So that's where the money is, Anya. In terms of the Smarter Balance.
Well, with the whole, move towards a Common Core, you see is a convergence in the test prep, the materials, the assessments, as well as the devices themselves. And this is a very large role for outside vendors and unprecedented in a lot of cases. And, it's a resource allocation issue because, master educators like the man who called in, that some people say, well, that's where our resources should be going, is to our training and equipping our teachers to do the best job and not to have this whole accountability apparatus, which is basically designed to catch the bad teachers.
Well, Timothy, thanks for the call. Again, our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we put standardized testing to the test. And John is in Westminster, Vermont. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Yeah, it was good to hear what that fellow up in Sugar Hill area had to say. He's got a good point because, our government and a lot of our country is run by these people that do pour lots of money into them. And I've always felt that our government caters to these people that give them the money, that our constituents and all. But kids do need to have the opportunities given to them, and
you mean take a test and see how they're doing, John? Or
yeah, to a point, it does have some bearing because that stuff gets put in a file. When I had it done way back 30 plus years ago, it's still sitting somewhere, perhaps, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything. Because I'm not against education. I think it's important to have a primary education, but, it shouldn't be the only thing you base a person's character on.
Yeah, John, this gets to Anya's point that you made earlier, Anya, that it isn't so much that this inherently is bad in and of itself, it's just that we are attaching too much to it. I think that's what he's trying to say and what you had said earlier. What do you think, Anya?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, the conception of what these tests are measuring, I think, is something we need to be critical about because, for a long time, this idea kind of hung around that there's this thing called IQ and it's fixed and it's determined at birth, it's genetic. And there was a whole lot of very odious ideology that came on top of that. But what educators today are really concerned with is people's capacity for growth and their diversity of achievements, the fact that there are different things that different people are good at, and that is what makes us valuable. And so a standardized test that is designed to test achievement in a very narrow set of areas is missing a whole lot of people. It's missing people who have artistic talents. It's missing people that are creative. It's missing people whose real skill is empathy. And it's missing people that just have incredible amounts of determination. And these are all areas that research tells us are crucial to people's success, and none of them are on these tests.
Well, that's really interesting. And I have to say, that's one of the parts of the book that jumped out the most for me, Anya, is you gather up a lot of the research on what children need to be successful in life. And like you just said, it's not high scores in reading and math. It's perseverance. It's grit. It's curiosity. You interviewed people at Google, which is a company that a lot of, young people would probably like to work for, my own included. What do the folks at Google say they're looking for? It wasn't high math scores.
It's so interesting, you know, these remarks, they were in the New York Times. Basically, the chief of hiring, the chief of people at Google said, we did the math. We're engineers. We correlated people's test scores and their GPAs when they entered with their performance as engineers, and we found that it didn't really matter as much. And what we're really looking for are these almost intangible qualities around leadership and around being a team player. And so they started to implement structured interviews, asking certain kinds of questions in certain ways, and really improved their ability to pick those people that would actually be high performers in the long run. And they found that it had nothing to do with GPA or test scores.
So how do you assess that? How do you figure out this person is going to have that leadership skill, that great teamwork skill, that curiosity that makes them want to take the extra step? How do you figure out that person A might be more like that than person B?
Well, different people have a lot of different ideas about how to do this.
Right.
And that's what's so interesting about
what's
going on right now.
It's not a fill in the bubble, is it? Yeah.
It's not going to be fill in the bubble. That's one thing that we know for sure. You know, some people say one tool that's being used on a school-wide basis to assess, you know, healthy social and emotional climate is these kinds of survey tools. And you basically ask people, how do you feel about coming to school every day? Do you have someone at school who cares about your success? And these very low-stakes assessments, when you project them out over long periods of time, have really powerful abilities to predict people's success, because what you're basically talking about is how you feel, how engaged are you in the process of school. So surveys is one way, structured interviews is one way, asking people's teachers, you know, about the students and the students' kind of social and emotional skills. There are behavioral tests that you can do where you give people tasks in a sort of experimental environment. Portfolios of work and performances where you have people directly demonstrate their knowledge. And these are all tools that are being used. Game-based assessments I talk about a little bit, which are designed to simulate an environment where someone might make a certain type of decision and then look at the decisions that they make. So the field is evolving, and it's very, very interesting.
Well, it is. And at the elementary level, Anya, you know, I do see the assessment including, you know, your child not only is doing fine in math and fine in reading or whatever, but there is a part of the assessment that says he or she's a team player, he or she gets along with others, he or she, you know, seems to have a problem following rules or doesn't. By the time they get to the high school level, it's an A, it's a B, it's a C. It gets very narrow.
It's so interesting, you know, because one of the trends that's in the picture here is the growth of interest in pre-K and high-quality preschool programs. And when you look toward what students really need to succeed, what young children need to succeed in sort of the 0 to 5 range, which, you know, President Obama is very concerned about, these are almost never academic or cognitive things. You know, what we're really looking for at that age are social and emotional development. And figuring out how to assess that, and not just how to assess it, that's not the important part. The important part is how to cultivate it. And that's something that our school system, you know, has a long way to go.
Is it really their job, though? I mean, cultivating social and emotional health sounds like a family value, a home value.
Well, parents have an enormous role to play in this. And, you know, I think parents have obviously the primary influence in their families. But, you know, public school is for all children, and the focus on pre-K, for example, and on social and emotional skills in general has a lot to say about, you know, we want all children to succeed, and unfortunately, not every child gets the optimal nurturing at home. So perhaps there's a role to play, not that the state could ever substitute for someone's family, but perhaps there's a role to play on a public school level. If you do get these kids 6-7 hours a day, what are we doing to advance these skills?
Let's take some more calls. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, again, we're taking a critical look at standardized testing, what role it plays right now in our public schools, what role it should play. Our guest is Anya Kamenetz. She's lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her book is called The Test. And let's go to L'Oreal in Bow. Hi, L'Oreal. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm really excited. We had a delay today. I'm on my way. I'm actually almost at school.
I was hoping we'd hear from a lot of teachers today. Yeah,
so I'm glad we had the delay so I got to catch this.
Great. Go ahead, L'Oreal.
Well, I think, Anya, you have so much to add, so many great insights, and I am excited to look for your book and hope to hear you more on NPR.
Thank you.
The title of the book has me curious because, just at face value, I haven't read it, I don't agree that schools are obsessed with the test or with standardized testing. I think as a public school educator, we are at the mercy of the state Department of Ed. And so in order to maintain our funding and our accreditation, then we have to demonstrate certain levels, and we have to participate in these tests. And it is disruptive at much of our school year is disrupted by taking these tests.
How much of your school year is disrupted, L'Oreal? Because this is a complaint that Anya looks at.
Okay, so I teach at Merrimack Valley Middle School.
Okay.
And we do testing at least twice per year at all three grade levels. It used to be kneecaps and NEWAs, and now obviously we're getting rid of kneecaps and transitioning into smarter ballots.
Right.
But most of these tests now will all be taken on computers, which is excellent. However, it ends up meaning we have limited resources. So all kids can't test at the same time. We don't have enough computers for all kids to test at the same time.
Yeah, and we talked about that. And I want to ask one more question, L'Oreal. I'm really interested since you're a teacher, and then I'll let you go. Here's the thing. We hear complaints that teachers spend too much time on the test, that it's all teaching to the test. Doesn't the test, L'Oreal, have some valuable information that kids need to know? I mean, if you're preparing for the test, it's got something in it that's worthy, doesn't it?
Well, I hope so. I don't teach a subject that's tested. And certainly it's nice because you have concrete data and everybody is, you know, getting the same test. And so I think the best value that I see is you can have a year-to-year comparative. And our school strives to acknowledge kids who demonstrate growth. And so as opposed to it having consequences, we try to use the lens of we want to recognize your successes, and so it has the possibility for recognition.
Okay. Well, L'Oreal, thank you, and good luck getting into school today. Lots of points from L'Oreal, but here's one that the first one she made, Anya. Schools are not obsessed with tests, she said. It's the people at the state level and the federal level. Don't blame us.
Well, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, you know, it varies from school to school. I certainly have met some schools and some school leaders who are very, very interested in sort of data-driven instruction and using the outcomes of tests on a daily basis to inform exactly what happens in the classroom. So, but, you know, I think a lot of the resistance from standardized tests, just as L'Oreal mentioned, comes from the perception or the experience that these tests are being imposed from the outside. They're not aligned to the curriculum. They're not testing what teachers are teaching. And you know, and oftentimes these test requirements are imposed without regard to the fact that, for example, if you have computers for only a third of your students, what are the rest of the students supposed to do while you're taking the test? You know, do they just sit on their hands, or are you able to continue instruction? And how disruptive is this on a collective basis to the whole process of school?
Let's take another call. This is Bill in Lyme. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. I'd like to build on the previous callers. I think that if the emphasis is upon the local community, then the national testing takes less importance. That I'm very much opposed to national standards, and New Hampshire, I think, is different from Vermont, which is different from California, and the communities within the state are different. Therefore, there ought to be some sort of school report card that is tied into the community and involves the community in the outcomes. I think that what you ought to do is focus on what is important and don't try to do everything. Each department tries to succeed at a particular task and then evaluate it.
Well, Bill,
I'd like to add another
yeah.
point on the evaluation. It bothers me that the national testing takes place and then people tie that to teacher evaluation, and that discourages the teacher's involvement with the whole student. Don't volunteer for any kind of activity director. Don't go to the games. Don't help the students because you're only being measured on the assessment.
So just focus on that test because so much is riding on it. You know, Anya, I want to ask you about something that I hear out of Bill's concern. And thank you, Bill, very much for the call. This dislike that a lot of people have for national testing. The argument for Common Core, though, and this is not a federal education standard, by the way. It was agreed to by, you know, more than 40 states at the state level. They signed on. It was voluntary.
Right.
But the concern that drove this national test and this national standard was, you know, some kids in California know one thing, some kids in Vermont know something else, and kids are at a disadvantage. Businesses said, you know, they had no idea what kids from different states knew. So that this was the argument for some national assessment.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, and it also was in some ways an acknowledgement that the No Child Left Behind system didn't do that, even though we wanted it to, because the federal law currently mandates that all states, you know, demonstrate or measure proficiency, but the law does not define proficiency. And so up until the Common Core came through, states were pretty free to define what they meant by proficiency, and they could choose their own test and their own passing score. And so the idea of bringing in some unified point of information about school performance so that you can easily make comparisons across the country, I think, you know, in principle has some merits. The question being whether, first of all, there's obviously grassroots swells of resistance to the idea of nationalization, because we've always had a lot of fierce defenders of local control when it comes to our education system. So that's one issue. And the second issue, of course, is, you know, the issues that I raise in the book about, well, do these high stakes tests really give us the type of information that we want, or are the stakes themselves imposing distortions on the information that come out of the tests?
You know, I came across an article by a woman from your state, actually, who is a former teacher and also wrote an impassioned defense of standardized tests. She's with a group that actually comes up with these tests. She said, public accountability is part of the social contract. How do we capture evidence of success in public schools? You know, she says test designers want to measure proxies of learning in order to provide evidence to answer questions about the health of our public schools. So what do you think about this point, Anya, that at some level we as a society need, deserve, want this information? We're all paying mm-hmm. into this. We're all hopefully getting something out of it. We deserve some measure of how it's going.
I think that describes a statement of principle about the type of assessment system we'd like to design. The one that we have has a lot of unintended consequences, and it trails behind it, you know, a lot of situations, a lot of experiences that people don't like. And so, you know, I would love to, you know, talk to that teacher about how to deal with the unintended consequences and design a system that in fact does what she'd like it to do.
Well, and maybe perfect segue after a break, Anya, we'll talk about what you write in the book, A Better Way to Do This. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Boston's Olympic bid. Dream or nightmare? Send us your thoughts before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Twitter or Facebook. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a look at standardized tests through a new book by NPR's lead digital education reporter, Anya Kamenetz. The book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Let's get your thoughts in our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Anya, before we go back to our listeners, so what is a better way? I mean, we're all kind of saying we need to assess how our school system is doing somehow, how our kids are doing somehow. What's a better way?
Well, you know, I think some of the major principles that test critics have brought forward are that we should always have multiple measures. We should never make decisions on the basis of a single test outcome. There are proposals coming in for simply testing less often and sampling students rather than testing every child every year. Some people are coming in and saying that the federal government should continue testing but should not be involved in accountability. So the idea there is that the federal government has a role to play, as they do, you know, across the board, collecting statistics, collecting evidence of learning, but should not be involved in imposing consequences, and that should be decided on the state level.
You know, the New York Times wrote a piece last fall that really got a lot of people's attention about the huge backlash against standardized tests in Florida. I wonder, a couple questions out of this. First, Anya, I wonder if different states are feeling the impact of standardized tests more than others. For example, Florida, also your state, New York, has been hotly debating standardized tests. What do you see as a national reporter in terms of state by state and how upset people are about standardized tests?
It's so interesting because, you know, you see really pretty high performing states like New York and lower performing states like Florida and Texas, both very, very incensed about standardized testing. And, you know, large, diverse states like California and smaller states like Rhode Island are upset and having big controversies over standardized testing. Some seem very much for political reasons. There are, you know, groups against the Common Core for very political reasons. In other states, or in other areas like Long Island, it's more driven on a grassroots basis from parents. So, you know, there's all kinds of reasons that states are concerned about the imposition of standardized testing. I think the theme that you can see is that people feel that these requirements are onerous, that they are taking over public education and defining it in a way that they don't want to see.
Well, and when the Times wrote about the backlash in Florida, as you might expect, Anya, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments. The vast majority of people agreeing with dissenters and agreeing with what you say, that standardized tests were ruining education. But a couple people made some points that I wanted to share with you and get your thoughts. Here's one person who says, with respect to testing, there is bountiful evidence that regular testing helps children learn the material better and differently than simply reading and following along without being tested. This person says, more regular testing applied uniformly across a common base standard of knowledge is a highly positive development. These are teething pains for something that will provide great long-term benefits to our kids and our country. You can't complain about U.S. students being in the bottom third of affluent countries when it comes to testing and then revolt when steps are taken to help kids learn more effectively. I just thought that was a really interesting comment. We complain so much about our kids are falling behind Finland and France and, you know, who knows else, Canada. And yet when we have these high-stakes testing regimes, we get upset.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, you have to separate out the difference between regular uniform tests that give students feedback, which is something that occurs on a weekly or biweekly basis in a good classroom, and annual tests that are dropped from the sky that, you know, that don't have any correlation necessarily directly to the student's curriculum and that don't give results for months on end. I mean, that's what state tests look like, and they don't relate closely to instruction in most schools. And then, you know, the international comparisons are always interesting to look at because it seems that there are high-performing countries that test students frequently, and there are high-performing countries that don't. There's no one-to-one correlation between annual testing and high performance on international exams like the PISA. And Finland, which is so often cited, is one of the countries that tests students the least often of any nation. Absolutely. In terms of standardized national tests, what you're going to find there is basically the high school exit college entrance examination and not that much else.
Kind of like when I think Massachusetts has a test where you're not allowed to graduate from high school unless you pass this test. Is that right? That's a high school exit test?
Right. That's a high school exit test. Yeah. And there are more and more states that are doing that. But yes, I mean, Finland doesn't do annual testing, and almost no country does the type of testing that we do, where the stakes are used to measure not only students themselves, but also schools and also teachers at the same time.
Let's take another call. Kathleen's in Center Harbor. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling in.
I just called it. I was sort of reacting to your comment about the Common Core being national. A state decision, but I just want to say that the way the tests are being used by the federal DOE is as kind of a stick in the stick and carrot metaphor. I think that schools and states don't have a choice anymore because of the way the federal government, and if you look at Manchester, they've decided they don't want to do the Smarter Balance test, and they've been threatened with withholding of all of their federal funds.
Yeah, this is a great point, Kathleen. Thank you for calling in. So let's just make sure we're all on track here, Anya. So even though Common Core was agreed to by the states at the state level, our caller's right, the federal government has gotten involved in using these tests.
Oh, my gosh, yes. So, you know, Race to the Top was enacted right after the financial crisis, and it offered a lot of money to schools from education funding for adopting a set of principles that included basically high standards, which everybody knew met the Common Core. And so there is this sort of arm's length rhetoric that the Common Core is a state initiative. And of course, technically, it is a state initiative, but that does not acknowledge the role of the federal government in incentivizing states at a time when they really were hurting for funding. They were having historic, you know, problems with their budgets, and they were offered these federal funds for accepting. And that is really the answer to the question of why so many states rushed to adopt these standards before they were even created.
Yeah. So Kathleen's right. It's not necessarily a federal program per se, but it was heavily incentivized or encouraged by the federal government.
And that, you know, and that's separate from the question of whether national standards are a good idea or not. You know, people react to that in principle. But that's a different question from educationally, might it be a good idea to have a common understanding of what students need to know and be able to do? And that's sort of what proponents of the Common Core say, is this is a perfectly reasonable idea and had a broad base of support when they were first introduced, that we should know, or we should have some idea, some agreement of what students in New Hampshire and students in Washington State need to know and be able to do.
So if people agree that, not everybody does, but if people agree right. that, and that's how Common Core came about, is that a lot of people said, hey, students in Washington State and New Hampshire should have at least a base of similar knowledge. So if people agree on that, why is it such a sticky wicket, Anya, to have a test that shows, okay, New Hampshire's getting it, Washington State isn't so much? What's the problem with that?
Well, one of the criticisms that's been leveled against the Common Core aligned tests created by Park and Smarter Balance is that they simply are not a big enough departure from the tests that came before them. You know, the Common Core has a lot of language in it about fewer, higher, deeper learning, critical thinking, evidence-based. And the tests themselves are still largely multiple choice.
Really?
And yeah. And I mean, you know, when I talked to the head of Smarter Balanced at the time, Joe Wilhoft, and he kind of pretty much admitted to me that they were under some severe constraints from the point that states would not adopt these tests if they were significantly more expensive to administer than the tests they came before. So they created a test that was right in the middle in terms of cost per head, about, you know, less than $30 a student to give these tests. And the fact is, if you want a test that tests all of these great things, you know, you need documents, you need a lot of writing on the test, like an AP exam, right? And those are graded by, you know, professionals in the field, and it costs $75 a person to take an AP exam. So for a third of the price, you're not going to get this kind of high quality test that you're looking for. And that's what experts who reviewed the test have said.
Let's take another call. This is Helen in Wanalancet. Hi, Helen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for your program.
Sure, go ahead, Helen.
Well, I'm a veteran teacher, 50 years or more, and I know that every year I taught, there was another initiative and another objective, another goal that we were supposed to accomplish. And my feeling is that testing is important, or at least assessment is, but data over the large tablet doesn't necessarily measure what you're trying to measure. I always believed that if you had a teacher that loved doing it and loved the kids and really looked at the kids and had the time to look at the kids and gave the students a chance to produce something, to put something together of their own based on the material in the framework you're teaching in, I was a chemistry teacher, that the rewards were huge. And I think it's very difficult to measure the results of, let's say, a project-based education. I don't want everybody in California to know exactly the same thing that all my students know. The world wouldn't work very well that way.
Well, Helen, a question for you then, since you had 50 years in the classroom, and wow, that's impressive. No standardized tests? A few
no.
standardized tests? What's your thought?
No, I think a few standardized tests, random sampling to see how things are going is great. But I found tests intrusive. Between that and other initiatives, it was very difficult to just concentrate on some ideas that we were trying to develop in the classroom. There was so much interruption, it was like somebody's day, you know, interrupted by cell phones, interrupted by computers, interrupted by bills, interrupted by everything. And education, to be good, needs some time and some concentration and some fun and things that are difficult to put in your curriculum if you have specific things you're supposed to be teaching to.
Well, Helen, it's great to hear from you. Wow, Anya, 50 years experience. What do you think? What do you pull out of Helen's comment?
Well, it's really impressive to me, and I hear these kinds of things over and over. And I think, you know, what we have to look at is the deprofessionalization of teaching. And that is really the theme that comes out when you talk to a lot of educators about standardization and standardized testing. That on the one hand, you know, I've heard from young teachers who say, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so I love that there are all these exams and there's all this data, there's all this information. You know, I'm young, I'm tech savvy, I'm using dashboards and I'm assessing students and this is great work. But then you have a lot of teachers who are really demoralized by it because they do, in fact, experience it as intrusive. And they say, this is interfering with my workflow. I'm a professional. Professionals are people that have the ability to be self-reflective and to constantly improve their practice. And so the question is, are we comfortable with a standardized regime that is designed, you know, it's not trusting our teachers. It's not trusting that our teachers are the ones that know how our students are performing. And it's really kind of from a point of view of trying to catch the really bad teachers and get the bad teachers out. And so, you know, a testing regime that is far more under the control of individual teachers requires that we train our teachers, that we equip our teachers, and that we be really confident that our teachers are doing a really great job. And so the question is, if we manage what we measure, if we do nothing but measure, what is it that we're managing inside the classroom?
You know, we talked earlier, Anya, about this, again, furor in Florida and the just many, many comments that came out of some New York Times coverage on that. Here's another comment that stemmed from that. Someone in Melbourne, Florida, someone named Jordan, says, this furor is largely driven by political correctness. Many parents, in fact, exactly the type of parents who like to get as deeply involved in their kids' schooling as humanely possible, are driven absolutely by their perception that their kids are being judged, and in some cases judged inferior to other kids in school. These parents are helicopter parents who are driven to distraction by the fact that this is an activity not which everyone gets a trophy. He concludes by saying, he's a lot more to say, but he concludes by saying, parents grow up, testing happens in all facets of life for as long as they and their kids live. And there were a couple other comments like this too, that look, life is tough. We're always being assessed at our jobs and so forth. We're always being held up to a standard that we need to meet or not. So just, I think somebody else wrote a comment, I don't want to say exactly what this person said, but basically grow up. What do you think? I mean, you know, the world's tough. Get used to it.
Well, you know, I wrote this book partly from my own perspective as a parent, and I do have to acknowledge that, you know, part of the anxiety around testing is very much focused on the parents themselves, kind of feeling that they're the ones being judged and that, you know, if their child doesn't hit every single milestone, if they're not, you know, demonstrating at genius level by the time they're 3 years old, that this is a personal failure. And it's part of how high stakes the process of parenting has become. And so, you know, I really ask parents to reach inside themselves and gain a little bit more insight around, you know, how do you really feel about the standards that your child is being held to? And ultimately, what we're trying to do, I think, is raise children who have an internalized sense, not only of well-being, but of self-improvement, that they want to be motivated to continue and to work hard and to try their best. And the question is whether, you know, the anxiety of high-stakes testing is the best way to cultivate that kind of mindset in our students, and particularly what we as parents can contribute to making that sure that that environment is happening.
And again, in some districts, in some schools, with some teachers, it seems like it's less high stakes, Anya. I have not heard in New Hampshire, at least in our district, the anxiety that you seem to be hearing in your district in New York and in other districts around the country.
Well, I think that's very true, and I think it's important to look at. You know, the anxiety, the districts and the areas that seem to be suffering the most from these testing regimes fall into two categories. There are, you know, unfortunately, low-income communities that where every child is in danger of being labeled failing year after year, and every school is in danger of closing. Charter schools that open up are in danger of closing within 5 years if they can't demonstrate test score growth. And so an awful lot of the schools in urban districts really feel the need to make everything about the tests. And
then it's demoralizing to be, you know, labeled year after year. Yeah, go ahead.
It's entirely demoralizing. That's exactly right. And then on the higher end, you have the high anxiety districts, high income districts that are really pushing themselves to kind of go above and beyond. And that creates, you know, a different kind of situation, but high anxiety as well.
Well, last quick question for you, Anya. Will we ever, as a country, come up with a system that satisfies most people? We're not going to satisfy everybody, but most people in terms of accountability, good information, and so forth. What do you think?
I think we're evolving, and I think we're evolving more quickly than some people might realize. The changes that have come in the last decade and a half have been enormous, and even more changes are on the table. And so, you know, there's not going to be stasis anytime soon, but I think there's a lot of interesting possibilities.
All right, Anya, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you so much.
Anya Kamenetz, again, lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.